Okay, let's start with a little thought experiment. When I say the words nursery rhyme, what's the first thing that pops into your head?
Probably something from Disney, singing birds, a princess.
A very clear line between good guys and bad guys.
Exactly. Everything's safe and sanitized for kids.
But if you actually go back to the original source material, the old folklore, it is terrifying. It's just full of violence and abandonment.
Morality tests, survival against the odds. It's
yeah.
basically where we put our collective nightmares.
And today, we're doing a deep dive into an artist who understood that better than almost anyone. We're talking about the late, great Paul Arago.
And we're working from a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Lawrence Schaaf that covers her whole life. I mean, this isn't just the biography of a painter.
No, it really isn't. It's more like a case study in how storytelling can be a weapon.
It is. We're going to explore how a repressed girl from Portugal grew up to become a dame of the British Empire, and how she used her art to fight fascism, to challenge the patriarchy,
and to literally change national laws. That's the part that blew my mind. She didn't just paint pictures for a gallery. She painted images that actually swayed voters.
But to get there, you have to understand the world she was born into, because as the sources make very clear, Paul Arago's childhood was not a Disney movie.
Far from it.
She was born in Lisbon in 1935. And the context here is just, it's crucial. This was the era of the Estado Novo, the new state.
Salazar's fascist dictatorship. For anyone who might not be a history buff on mid-century Portugal, what did that actually feel like?
Suffocating. I mean, the regime's motto was God, country, family. It was intensely conservative, Catholic, authoritarian.
And there's a secret police force, right?
Oh, yeah. Informants, torture. Censorship was everywhere. Books, newspapers, plays. You just couldn't say what you thought.
And if it was bad for everyone, the notes suggest it was doubly oppressive for women.
Absolutely. The regime pushed this ideal of the little saint.
The little saint.
Women were supposed to be domestic, obedient, pious, basically invisible. Legally, a woman was treated like a child, couldn't open a bank account, couldn't travel abroad without her husband's written permission.
That's just wild. You're a grown woman and you need a permission slip to leave the country.
Exactly. And on top of that, illiteracy rates were some of the highest in Europe. The whole strategy was just keep people in the dark, keep them quiet.
But inside Paul Arago's own house, the vibe was a bit different. Her dad was an electrical engineer, and the sources say he was a staunch anti-fascist.
He was. He knew the regime was rot. He'd even buy her books that were critical of the, the bourgeois hypocrisy of the time.
But the dynamic with her mother was complicated.
Very. Her mother was an artist herself, but the lectures point out this really sad detail. She gave Paula almost zero encouragement.
Even when she was drawing on the floor at age 4.
Even then. So she didn't get that validation from her mom. She found her inspiration somewhere else.
Her grandmother.
Her grandmother. The storyteller. When her father was away working in Britain, Paula was left with her grandmother, who told her these traditional oral folk tales.
And these were the scary ones.
The visceral ones. Stories about ants eating people, about children being punished. But here's the key insight from Dr. Schaaf. For a little girl living in a frightening dictatorship, these scary stories were actually comforting.
Wait, how is a story about ants eating people comforting?
Because they validated her fear. The world outside was scary. The secret police were real. The oppression was real. But the government kept saying, everything is fine.
So the horror stories felt more honest than the news.
Precisely. And that lesson stuck with her for life. That dark stories are a way to reveal the truth.
So she grows up, goes to an English-speaking school, then a finishing school she hated, and eventually decides on art school in London. And this is my favorite anecdote in the research. The irony is just perfect.
It is wonderful. Her legal guardian, a man named David Phillips, steered her away from the Chelsea School of Art.
Because he had heard a rumor.
Yes. He had heard that the female students at Chelsea often became pregnant. So he thought the Slade School of Fine Art was much safer.
The respectable choice.
And almost immediately upon arriving at the Slade, Paula meets a fellow student, Victor Willing, who was already married, by the way, and she gets pregnant.
You can't make this stuff up.
And that relationship with Victor Willing really became the anchor of her entire life. He became her intellectual partner, her critic, and the central subject of so much of her work.
Okay, so let's get into that work. Her stuff from the 1960s, it's not what people picture when they think of Paul Arago. It's chaotic. It's collage.
Yeah, she was literally cutting up the world. It's a violent process, collage. You're ripping things apart. Dr. Schaaf argues it perfectly matched her anger at the dictatorship. She wanted to cut it up.
Which brings us to a piece from 1960 called Salazar Vomiting the Homeland.
Chuckles. Not subtle, is it?
Not at all.
And the image is grotesque. You see this bulbous figure, Salazar, in these sickly yellows and browns, and he's just regurgitating the country.
It's meant to be disgusting.
And in the mess, there are these hidden symbols. There's a sinking ship, for example, which is a total rejection of the regime's obsession with Portugal's glorious maritime history.
So she's in this phase of just pure political rage. But then in the mid-60s, something shifts. The anger turns into something heavier.
Grief. The year 1966 was just devastating for her. Her father died. And in the same year, her husband Victor was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Wow, a brutal 1-2 punch.
It changed everything. She painted a piece called The Firemen of Alijo, based on the local firemen who failed to save her father's house from a fire.
And this introduces a theme the notes call failed heroism.
Exactly. The figures are like stiff wooden dolls, bad actors in a play. They couldn't save the house, just like the doctors couldn't save her father and couldn't save Victor. She's moving away from abstraction and starting to tell stories again.
And that narrative style just explodes in the 1980s. This is what the sources call classic Rigo. The collages are gone. Now we have these solid three-dimensional figures. They look real, but the situations are
weird, unsettling. They're like psychological thrillers.
Domestic thrillers. She takes the home, this supposedly safe space, and just fills it with tension.
Mm-hmm.
The standout for me here is The Policeman's Daughter from 1987. Can you describe this one for us? The details really matter.
It's a very stark image. A young woman sitting by a window, and she's polishing a boot. But it's not just any boot. It's a massive black military jack boot.
It looks like it belongs to a giant.
It's huge. It represents the state, the police,
yeah,
the authority. And she's cleaning it, but the way she's cleaning it is disturbing. Her arm is shoved deep inside.
It looks so aggressive.
It is. Rego told the model, who was her own daughter, by the way, to shove her hand into it. Don't just cuddle it, she said. She was actually inspired by a very sexually explicit Robert Mapplethorpe photo.
So on the surface, she's a dutiful daughter, a little saint, but underneath.
Underneath, it's about the complexity of living under tyranny. She serves the boot, she polishes its symbolic shine, but there's a violation happening. It's that mix of obedience and rage.
You hate the boots, but you keep it clean to survive.
Precisely. And she explores that same ambiguity in The Family from 1988, which she painted while Victor was dying.
Right. It shows a man on a bed, and these two women are. What are they doing to him?
You can't tell. Are they dressing him or undressing him, helping him up or holding him down? It's about that gray zone of caregiving. It's love, but it's also a burden. It's care, but it's also coercion.
And then, after he passes away, she paints the dance.
One of her most haunting works, figures dancing on a moonlit beach. You see a woman dancing alone on the left, that's Rigo. But on the right, she's dancing with a man.
And that's Victor.
It is. But since he was gone, she had her son, Nick, put on his father's suit and pose for the painting.
Oh, man. That must have been unbelievably emotional.
Nick said there was a palpable grief. He's literally stepping into his dead father's shoes to help his mother say goodbye.
So she's moved through political anger, through personal grief. And then in 1990, she gets this huge appointment, first associate artist at the National Gallery in London.
A very big deal. The establishment is embracing her. And what does she do?
She goes right back to those nursery rhymes.
And gives them the full Rigo treatment.
Yeah.
She did a series of etchings that just subvert the whole idea of childhood innocence. You have to look at her Little Miss Muffet.
The spider is not a cute little thing in the corner.
No, it's enormous. It has a human face. And it's reaching out to stroke her knee. It's predatory.
It feels like a warning.
It is. She's showing us these stories were never safe. They were always about power and fear and often the threat posed by men.
She did something similar with the mural she painted for the gallery, Crivelli's Garden.
Right. She was commissioned to paint saints, but she didn't paint them as these ethereal angels. She used the women who worked in the gallery cafeteria and her own family as models.
Real working women.
Exactly. There's a depiction of Judith with the head of Holofernes, but instead of being this high drama, bloody moment, Judith, it just looks like she's casually showing the severed head to a child. Like, look what I found.
It grounds the mythology, makes it almost a chore.
It suggests that dealing with violence and heavy burdens is just part of women's daily work.
Okay, we have to talk about the 1990s, because her style changes physically. She puts down the brushes and picks up pastels. Why?
Dr. Schaaf says she loved the tactility. With painting, there's a brush between you and the canvas. With pastel, it's just the stick and your fingers. You can rub it, scratch it, smash it.
It's more aggressive, more physical.
And that physicality was a perfect match for her new subject matter, the dog women.
This is a series that I think a lot of people find really challenging.
For sure. You see women crouching, scratching, baying at the moon. On the surface, it looks degrading. Calling a woman a dog is an insult. But Rigo insisted it was the opposite.
So how is being a dog empowering?
Because a dog doesn't care if you think it's pretty. A dog growls when it's angry, sleeps when it's tired. These women possess what critics called erotic vitality. They aren't posing for the male gaze.
They're not being the little saint.
Not at all. They're just existing in their bodies. And that reclamation of the female body leads directly to her most historically significant work.
The abortion series from 1998. This is where art and politics collide.
Literally. In 98, Portugal held a referendum to legalize abortion. And it failed. The law stayed. Abortion remained a crime. And Rigo was furious.
She'd been open about having had them herself.
Yeah, she knew that keeping it illegal just meant poor women suffered in backstreet clinics, so she decided to paint what that suffering looked like.
But, and this is the genius of it, there's no blood. There's no gore.
And that was a conscious choice. If she'd painted blood, people would have looked away. It would have been dismissed as shock art. Instead, she painted the gaze. You see women crouching on beds, in pain, exhausted, looking right at you.
It forces you to sit with their suffering.
It forces you to see the human cost. It creates empathy, not just revulsion.
And these didn't just stay in a London gallery.
No. When a second referendum was scheduled for 2007, these images were circulated in Portuguese newspapers. They were everywhere.
And the result?
The 2007 referendum passed. Abortion was legalized. And Paula Rigo is widely credited with helping sway public opinion.
That is just incredible. She used her canvas to fight at the ballot box.
She forced a society to look at something it wanted to ignore. And she never stopped doing that. In 2002, she was commissioned to paint the Virgin Mary for the presidential chapel in Lisbon.
The highest honor in a Catholic country.
But she didn't paint the Holy Card version. Her Annunciation doesn't show a serene queen. It shows a terrified schoolgirl.
And the Nativity.
Shows a woman in the real physical agony of childbirth. She stripped away all the miracle gloss and showed the biological reality.
Stripping away the gloss seems to be the theme right to the very end.
Absolutely. In her 80s, she was tackling female genital mutilation. She never shied away.
And yeah, we have to mention the self-portraits from 2017.
Oh, they're hard to look at. She'd had a bad fall and her face was, it was bruised, battered. Most people would hide until they healed.
Rigo went to the mirror and started drawing.
She said, I didn't like the fall, but the self-portraits I like doing. Self-portrait the third shows her bruised, distorted face, mouth open. It's brutal.
It's a refusal to be invisible, even as an old, injured woman.
She called it a taboo-breaking daze. She was using her own injury to explore mortality. She was saying, I am here. I am hurt. I am old. And I am not hiding it.
She worked almost to the very end. Passing away in 2022.
And she leaves behind a legacy that just fundamentally changes how we see women in art. She took the female experience, which was always dismissed as domestic or trivial, and she made it monumental. She made it scary and powerful and just undeniable.
So if we step back, what's the big takeaway from Paula Rigo for us today? We started with scary stories.
I think Rigo teaches us that the scary story is actually a survival tool. Whether it's a nursery rhyme about a spider or a painting of a backstreet abortion or a sketch of a bruised face, these things force us to confront reality.
And we live in a world that loves to polish the boot. We like things shiny, curated, perfect, especially online. We want the Disney version.
Exactly. And Rigo challenges us to stop polishing the boot and look at what's inside. She asks us to respect the ugly truths because that's where the real humanity is.
That's a powerful place to leave it.
All right.
So here's a question for you. In your own life, are you brave enough to look at the bruised face of reality, or are you still just trying to keep everything shiny?
Something to think about.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.